Hello, everyone. In this episode, we connect with Dr. Melon McKay, the founder and CEO of KoalaPay, a direct funding platform that connects users to trusted grassroots actors working to sustain and strengthen their communities. Dr. McKay is an anthropologist by training and has spent years working in emerging markets with some of the largest institutional donors in the world. She's now bringing that knowledge and expertise to make sure more grant money makes it into the hands of expert local actors. Listeners interested in the intersection of international development, impact investment, and blockchain should also check out episodes 11 and 26 with Dr. Hamid Rashid, episode 25 with author Brett Scott, and episode 13 with entrepreneur Dr. Sean Conway. We hope you enjoy the episode.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Dr. McKay. Do you want me to call you Dr. McKay or Melon? Which do you prefer?
You know, I normally let people call me Melon McKay, but if somebody I feel like really deserves it, I will ask them to call me doctor. So I think in this case, we can go with Melon.
Good. Because I didn't want to just jump in and assume a level of familiarity. You want to make sure that we respect your title. Thank you for joining us, Melon. So first, how are things going?
Yeah, going really well. I mean, as I think anyone who's working in the space can attest, it's been a very strange few months, but one that a period that I think is actually really necessary and ultimately will be really beneficial for everyone who has sort of genuine intentions to build something that's lasting and that benefits the larger sort of good will of humanity. So all in all, I think it's a healthy readjustment, but you know, a readjustment nonetheless.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny for, you know, the bare winter to be happening in the hottest goddamn time of year here in Barcelona, where I'm sweating my damn face off. But yes, it is indeed still a winter. But hey, thanks for making the time to join us in the middle of, you know, all the stuff you're working on, which we're going to get into
on the pod here.
So we like to start out usually by just asking our guests to give us their origin story if they have one, right? What is the sort of myth of Melon? And, you know, where did you start? How did you get to where you're at today? And pick whichever point you like to start at and let us know.
Well, it's funny that you use the word origin story, because I think the first tweet that we ever put out with KoalaPay was a link to the State of Humanitarian Funding Report, which shows, of course, that humanitarian funding goes, like, less than 5% of it in total goes to local organizations. And I think the tweet comment was, what's your origin story? And I had actually wanted to say, what's your villain origin story? But then I thought better of it before tweeting it. But to be honest, I think my personal origin story is very much intertwined with that concept. I grew up in a very rural part of the United States in northern Utah. And I was not part of the majority population there. And so I experienced a very strange form of marginalization, which intersected with both issues of state coercion and misogyny, both of which have been really central to my academic and professional work ever since. So basically, I'm fascinated by the question, what makes people participate in and support movements and moments that are seemingly inimical to their own well-being? And not just support those things, but actively work at ensuring their underlying ideologies become totalizing in the environments that they inhabit. And I guess you could say I have a knee-jerk reaction to proselytizing of any kind, which is actually why it took me a while to come around on crypto, but we can get into that later.
Oh, for sure. That makes a ton of sense, right? If you're coming out of, you know, like you said, in these areas where people are trying to totalize their own ideologies and they're out in a marketplace of ideologies, then you're going to be very suspicious of those folks who come in and say, hey, right this way, we have Bitcoin as the answer. Have you considered it?
Exactly. This is the one true God. And I'm like, I've heard this pitch before.
Yes. You know? I believe I've heard this one. It was Cayman Curry's book form is Bearded Man, etc. Cool. So you came up in northern Utah. You, like you said, you experienced a degree of marginalization. Honestly, it's very interesting. Not what I expected. So super interesting. Not, you know, there's various forms of intersectional oppression that, you know, happens on all kinds of different axes around gender, race, etc. So this is one of those things where you're like, oh yeah, actually, it turns out even in nice old Utah, things like that happen. So,
well, the majority community is Mormon in Utah, and where I grew up, that was 90% or something of the population. And that, so it is a funny one when I say to people, you know, in my high school, I was sort of considered part of the minority community because I wasn't Mormon, even though, you know, visibly I am a, like, white cis woman, you know, like I'm WASPy in every possible way, you know,
yeah.
maybe not really, but that's how I present to other people. And so it's just very funny that that was, I was treated by the majority community in the way that I was. So it's an odd way to grow up for sure.
And then that basically informed your experience that you ended up going to college, and then kind of walk us through your intellectual journey.
Yeah. Well, I first started out in global public health. I was a Global Health Corp fellow in Burundi, and I was placed in a Partners in Health associated clinic in an area which had seen a significant amount of violence. I think many people are completely unaware that the dynamics which played out in the Rwandan genocide also played out in Burundi next door. And I became really interested in both how contestations for control of nation states magnify, perpetuate, and create schisms in social cohesion, and that that has a lasting impact on things like health access. But I also became really fixated with this question of how the international community responds to those schisms. Burundi was very inconvenient in that sense for the international response, because the Hutus in Burundi in the end were the ones who came to power. And they came to power under a Kirundi and French-speaking former PE teacher with a penchant for tracksuits. And it really muddled the story that was being told for linguistic and other reasons. And Rwanda became what's called a donor darling country, whereas Burundi became a donor orphan country, despite the same factors having been at play really in the conflict. And so it became really clear to me that this intersection of the state and violence and international management of risk really informed basically every other human experience. So I started to look then at contestations of various regimes, especially non-state terrorism. I'm using ample like air quotes
air
here
quote
because
fingers. Yes, I can attest.
Yeah, because all of these terms, you know, I think you could dig into for a variety of reasons. But I think what I was really interested in was why women in particular might engage those strategies as a means of gaining access to various benefits, ranging from healthcare to physical protection, et cetera. And it was in Burundi that I first encountered the idea that women who may otherwise be prevented from participating or even existing in high status spaces might come to see forms of violence as a means of engaging in a kind of moral self-making, which was enabled by and within those spaces. And concretely, in the case of Burundi, rampant misogyny made it extremely difficult for women, especially rural women, to participate in religious leadership. And what that meant was that for many women, the only socially valued means they had of demonstrating their religious piety was encouraging their sons to go off to jihadi training camps.
Wow, interesting.
Yeah. So after a few years of focus on that intersection of women and violence, not as victims of violence, which I think is really important, but as perpetrators of violence, I found that any conversation, and this will not surprise anyone, but any conversation which touched on Islam was just totally moribund by debates about the inherent, again, quotes, inherent violence of Islam.
Yes.
Or to quote Lulu Abu Lubert, the, you know, do Muslim women really need saving? And I just found that those questions made it so that conversations in that space were just not really productive. And so after field placements in South Sudan, I was in Juba for a little bit before the latest civil war. I was in Lebanon working on the Syria response. And I came across the situation in Myanmar, Burma. And I will talk a little bit about why I use that, the Myanmar / Burma later. But basically, just like in global minority countries or like global Northwest, they struggle to see women's violence. And they also struggled to see Buddhist violence. So that seemed like a really perfect place to dig into that question and in a way where people were going to be maybe bringing a few less preconceived notions into the conversation. So I focused on a group called Mabata, which is Amyobada Sanshayapwe. And it means the Committee for the Protection of Race and Religion in Burmese language. And I get a fair bit of pushback sometimes on the translation of the word Amyo as race, because some people think it's better translated as nation. And my core argument against that is that, and this came out of my 2 years of participant research with the group's female members, but it's that Myanmar Burma is not a real thing. It's not a concrete entity, and it's contested by numerous actors, including a diverse set of armed organizations. And so to insist that Amyo means nation is akin to arguing that the Burmese ethnic identity is what makes the nation. And even though that's what a lot of, you know, governments have now acknowledged implicitly or explicitly, I would argue instead that Mabata is actually really focused on creating a pan-Buddhist polity, which is multi-ethnic. And again, I can go into more detail there.
Oh, it's super interesting because I think like I was having a conversation with someone today, literally about, you know, I'm from Afghanistan. And so like when you ask me, and I mean, this is probably going to, you know, make a few of my Afghan friends mad, but I don't really think there is an Afghanistan, right? There's like, there are Pashtuns, there are Azaras, there are Tajiks, there are a bunch of other folks, but this whole Afghan nation state thing, depends on who you ask, basically.
Yeah. And I think that's a common difficulty in wanting to engage in the predominant discourse on what's happening within a sort of international framework of power to various different actors and entities within that framework, especially those that have been historically marginalized or disenfranchised by the actions of other members within that international hierarchy. And then the sort of intellectually honest conversation, which becomes much more complicated and uncomfortable because, in essence, I would never want to be the person who says that your right to self-determination or to identification as a group or an entity is any of my business.
Yeah.
But at the same time, anytime someone, even actors from within those groups, is making a claim to their sort of essential status, I get uncomfortable because I just think that's a losing game, first and foremost.
For sure.
And it also doesn't move us along the path of working towards a more equitable sort of human existence, which is what I think I'm most concerned with.
Oh, for sure. And I think that is a great background into, you cross into some really interesting worlds, right? Because you've done this extensive work for your PhD thesis at Oxford, looking at feminism, nationalism, violence, the various sorts of players that play in Burma and the Burmese nation state. But then you've also worked with a number of aid organizations, not just in Burma. So tell us, like, how did you have this intellectual background and then you also worked in aid? How did you end up getting into aid?
Yeah. Well, I wanted to go back to your point about the sort of feminist focus. I have consistently told people that I'm not a gender specialist. That's a whole area of work in the international aid industry, and I don't understand myself in that way. That said, I have repeatedly and intentionally leveraged what I would call benevolent sexism as a means of gaining access to certain spaces in groups. So when you turn up and you look youngish and female, it means sometimes that you can ask pretty audacious questions without setting off the kind of alarm bells that the standard masculinist theater does. So men in positions of power, including armed groups and monks, have told me a lot of pretty sensitive stuff, in part because I think they're really looking at me and seeing me just as a sort of like harmless, maybe slightly silly woman who needs to be educated. So in that sense, you know, the sort of mansplaining phenomenon can really be to your advantage if you're a researcher, because people want to explain things to you, which is perfect if you're an anthropologist. Very annoying in other parts of life, but
yeah. But this is good to know, though, for anyone out there who's like considering doing a thesis,
who
presents cis white and female. There you go.
If you want to work with armed groups, you know, honestly, I have found it to be more of a benefit than a drawback. Obviously, there are a lot of caveats to that. In any case, I basically, you know, had been doing my academic work and the nonprofit work simultaneously. So it's kind of hard to say that one led to the other. It's not that neat of a trajectory. But what I would say is that I started out in this Global Health Fellowship in Burundi. And when I finished that, I hung around in Bujumbura for another year and picked up basically whatever work that I could. And I've always seen myself as a researcher, so that was a natural fit. And I moved into research and evaluation, or what's often called monitoring and evaluation, which is basically just research you do to either inform the design of an intervention or to determine how successful the intervention is in delivering against its regular objectives or has been in terms of its larger impact goals. And I think it says a lot that this is an aspect of the aid machinery where you see almost exclusively foreigners at senior levels. And to be clear, this is a problem throughout the whole industry. but a lot of the big consultancy firms or small consultancy firms in the space are led by white men. And you go down the hierarchy, maybe see a few more women, normally also white. And then at the junior levels, you have folks who start to look more like the communities in which the research is conducted. The reality is that that aspect of the aid industry is really, the research and monitoring side is really about risk management for donors. And in that sense, the primary focus is fiscal responsibility, you know, like paying much closer attention to how aid money is used in places that actually need it than say like policing budgets. But, you know, it's also on this focus on desired outcomes, most of which are set by donors themselves with very, very little community consultation. So that makes sense when you see that donor giving at the highest levels is an expression of soft diplomatic aims, but it does still mean that, you know, ultimately I sort of got involved in that space specifically because I saw it as the best place for me to do harm reduction. The reality is, unfortunately, these interventions are going to take place. You know, colonialists are going to colonial. But I saw it as a means of doing what I could to amplify local voices and train up other researchers from those communities, helping to support them and accessing the spaces where decisions were being made. And a huge part of that is language acquisition. And I don't just mean speaking fluent English or French. Plenty of people speak those languages as well or better than so-called native speakers. But there is a specific lexicon of aid and knowing how to use it effectively. And I saw working in that space as the best way to kind of combine my personal feelings about the aid sector with what I saw my skill set as being.
Got it. So I think you touched on something pretty interesting there that we had. Sean Conway was on the pod probably 10, 12 episodes ago. But
yeah, was Sean's a legend.
Yeah, one of the things that he also pointed out, which you touched on here, is this idea of co-designing interventions with the folks who will be the target of them, right? So like to actually design outcomes that they would want instead of having donor advised, you know, approaches to, hey, I want you to do this or that. And so from the sound of it, it looks like you had an up close, upfront, you know, specific view on seeing that come to fruition. So amongst that, you know, what were other sort of major problems you've observed in aid in your experience?
Oh, where to begin? I mean, look, I have obviously benefited from the aid machinery. I've been a part of it for the last decade. So when I make these criticisms, I'm also criticizing myself. And I think that's really important because, you know, the vast majority of people who get into aid work, they do it, you know, I think genuinely with a desire to do good for the world. But what's important to understand is that the systems and structures are so totalizing that it is very easy for you to get sucked into them and to suddenly become complicit in, even though you started out with very different intentions. So this is my way of acknowledging that, you know, and setting the tone here that the criticisms to follow are criticisms that I would also, you know, point towards myself. But I would say that, I mean, as I've touched on a little bit recently, there are two major issues as I see them. The first is that the agendas are set by global minority countries and their interests far more often than they are set by people from the global majority countries in which the activities take place. And as a result, whether or not funding continues or is extended in the first place is generally determined by a level of political will, which is so far removed from the people who are actually being affected by whatever the dynamics at play are. And it's also that the degree of success of existing programs is determined, as I said, by measurements that are set, metrics, which likely none of those receiving the aid actually consented to or had a part in dreaming up. And so what that means is that to keep receiving money, you have to become a donor service organization, not a community responsive organization. And that in turn means that the aid industry effectively cannibalizes the structures which emerge at the first level of social organization to, you know, forcing them to professionalize in a very particular way so that they're better able to implement the global minorities agenda. So they're easier to work with for people who look like me, not because they're better at doing the job that needs to be done for their communities. And all of that makes it harder for them to then later safely identify, articulate, and advocate for community needs. So that's problem one. Problem two is that ecosystem has so many intermediaries. I think if the average person sat down and saw how even a small aid program is designed in terms of the various levels, and then applied just basic, you know, maths to that structure, you would see then why it is that this teeny tiny percentage of aid money ends up with local actors, even though they're doing the riskiest and probably the most impactful work. The average INGO, and again, I've been part of this system, so this is a criticism of myself as well, but the average INGO spends 80% more on finance than a multinational corporation of the same size and scale. 80%. And they are playing an enormous role that they are not institutionally designed to play, acting as pass-through entities for donor funds that ultimately need to go to local actors. And so it's very, and I think, you know, as part of this as well, it's also very easy to tuck overhead costs into program budgets. So a much better metric of efficiency is spending on aid activities. If you wanted to really see which INGOs, which programs were doing good work, you wouldn't look at the comparison of overhead spending to program spending. You would really want to look at the spending on activities, but you will really struggle to find that because not a lot of organizations want to publish that information.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point because in the very little, you come from this world, and the very little that I know of it, you know, some of the folks who've done some of this work are in like in the effective altruism movement, right? And like those guys I have my own criticisms of their movement, yeah. But I think that, you know, like you said, you can go to something like Charity Navigator, and I don't remember ever seeing something like that, like the figure you're talking about, like aid spent on actions, but you can very easily get overhead versus, you know, administrative overhead, administrative expenses, right?
Yeah. And I think what you need to understand, and what anyone needs to understand if they're interested in this, is that if you're giving to a program, let's say that if you or your business normally gives money to a nonprofit working internationally, and you're really lucky, you have a matching program with your company. And so combined, you give $10,000 of aid per year to a charity of your choice, which your employer approves of. The way the spending works in the sector means that either you or your employer's contribution is essentially moot. It's going to go to paying someone like me to write a white paper that no one in the decision-making authority is ever going to heed or probably even look at. And that's just the way the sector works. And so I think, you know, the other issue is obviously that it's, like I said, very easy to disguise overheads as program funds. And so, you know, what it constitutes program spending is pretty broad. So if you have someone from France who's sitting in Rakhine State in Sitwe in Myanmar, they could be doing very little. They could be doing what's normally called access sort of work, which is negotiating or trying to advocate for better humanitarian access, which in a lot of places in the world is really not very successful because the people who do have access already are the local actors and local organizations. So the fact that you're spending money to, you know, for somebody who has a high salary, who requires a lot of protection because they stand out in that community, who can't speak the language, is getting paid a lot of money to sit there and advocate for people like them to be able to gain direct access to communities, when that money could be used instead to just directly help communities via local organizations. I think it says a lot about, when I say there are too many intermediaries, what it is I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah. That actually makes it really makes it more concrete, right? Because like people say intermediaries, like, okay, I just imagine money changing hands multiple times with a little bit of it coming off here and there. Now that makes it a bit more, you know, real. So yeah, definitely.
And I think on that intermediary point too, money changing hands, it's not just that it goes through these various different decision makers. It's that it literally passes through like five banks to get to where it's going a lot of the time. And so it's, you know, for example, somebody who wants to give money, who say you make a donation from the United States, that ends up going to an INGO's bank account in the UK. And then that INGO sends that money to Singapore. And then from Singapore, there's another transfer to Bangkok. And then from Bangkok, there's a hawala transfer, an informal cross-border cash transfer that happens between Bangkok and Myanmar, because no one in Myanmar wants to use the formal banking system right now, understandably.
Yes.
So any point in that chain, you are going to lose time, you're going to pay fees, and there's the risk that somebody could flag that transaction for whatever reason, you know, because they don't understand how Burmese names work. And they think that the person receiving the money is actually on sanctions list. So at any point, somebody can intervene in that that transfer of money. And I think, you know, that also is what I mean when I talk about too many intermediaries.
Yeah, that's a really good point, I think. And just so everyone's clear, in case you're not up on it, the military, there's a military dictatorship in Burma, that there's a military junta that came back into power. What is it, 6 months ago? When was it?
No, it's been about a year now, more than a year, to look at where we are in the calendar. But it all happened sort of overnight. I think a lot of people thought it was coming, but there were a lot of, you know, Western analysts and others who kept saying, surely not, no, the junta would never be that stupid. The military would never be that stupid. But, you know, that proved to be false. And the political actors that had been, quote unquote, democratically elected, and I think I use quotes there because the military never formally ceded power. The constitution of Myanmar was designed in a way to prevent a people's government from ever actually having levers of power.
That was like 2011, 2010?
The 2008 constitution is very problematic. It's part of the reason, within that constitution, there was a set aside for military to have seats in the parliament that was protected regardless of democratic outcomes. And so that's part of the reason why the NLD, Aung San Suu Kyi's party, had originally sort of protested the elections, because that they're not going to be free and fair. And anyway, this constitution is problematic. And then obviously eventually they did run and they did win in a landslide. And in this most recent election, they also won in a landslide. But of course, they never controlled, you know, the military. They never controlled home affairs, basically, anything to do with immigration. So there were a lot of ways that you could say they didn't actually have proper control of the country. And so to argue that it's a democratically elected government in exile is complicated for a bunch of reasons. But the people's elected government did go on to try to form a government called the National Unity Government, the NUG. There's a lot of really great acronyms in Myanmar right now. The military has formed its sort of governance body, which is called the SAC, the SAC. Oh, and the people kind of defense forces that have been developed to protect people around the country called PDFs. So there's a lot of, you know, fun language in the Myanmar response right now. But
well, I think this is important. This is a good important background for this, because, you know, as you walk through how money changes hands through the system, that really shows you, not necessarily, you know, saying that aid is broken, I don't think, is maybe a little bit too strong. It just shows you the reality of aid, right? Like what's happening in all the various places where it can go wrong when on one side of the earth, one party actually just wants to do what they think, you know, is right and good, and is trying to make, you know, do something, do their part. And on the other side, there's so many places where that can fail. So I think this is a great spot to sort of back into. You know, you pointed out, you numbered out a number of things here, you know, with your the 3 points, the major problems you observed in aid. Now backing into something like the solution that you're cooking up for this, and, you know, solution sounds totalizing as well. Just the thing that you're working on here to say, hey, I've identified some problems, right? Where did Koala Pay and enter this picture? Because, you know, you've had your aid background, you did your PhD. When did you say, hey, you know, maybe there's something we can do about this?
Yeah, I do want to stress that we definitely see what we're doing as offering an alternative means of solving some of the existing problems. We recognize that, as with anything, there will then be unintended consequences, which we'll need to monitor for and address as they arise. And so we're certainly not seeing this as a panacea for all of the problems within the aid industry, because that's bigger than anybody. You know, the fact that the aid industry exists is a reflection of the fact that there are places in the world where people cannot meet the basic needs for a dignified existence. And so any solution to that is going to be, you know, starting from the back foot, because it's reflecting the fact that something has already gone wrong. And so a solution is always going to be a response to that. It's not going to be offering something that is in and of itself a good way of doing things. Like in a perfect world, no one would need to be, that charity would not exist. Mutual aid might exist, maybe still, as a, you know, in recognition of the fact that people go through different, you know, stages of their lives and need help sometimes from their communities. But the idea of charity is a kind of institutionalized thing that happens as a transfer of wealth between wealthy nations to less wealthy nations as a way to stabilize them or develop them. All of that would not be existent if we lived in the kind of world that we wish we lived in. So all of that is a long preamble to saying that what we're doing with Koala Pay is offering an alternative that we think helps to solve or to address some of these problems that I've seen over the course of my career, but that is in no way a complete solution to what is a much, much bigger problem. So I'll be honest that Koala Pay emerged as a means of solving my own pain points and grievances. But
that's often how a lot of good ideas happen.
Yeah. But I normally articulate those in terms of three main issues. The first being that the bi and multilateral donors struggle to directly contract grassroots actors because their compliance regimes often don't recognize non-registered actors. However, where governments or financial systems are corrupt or abusive, official registration and use of like fiat bank accounts in a country is dangerous, just flat out dangerous. I think, you know, you can really see this in the context of Myanmar. There was a big, big, big push by the international aid industry to get local aid actors to formally register under the NLD civilian government, Aung San Suu Kyi's government. And this was done as a way to make it, as I said, easier for these international actors to give grants directly, but also because it was, and I don't know if anyone would actually say this out loud, but I think that a big part of this, and a lot of the local aid actors I know have said that they saw this as the international community's attempt to legitimize the NLD and Aung San Suu Kyi's people's government or civilian government at that time. What that meant was that a lot of these actors had to formally register with the state in order to receive any funding. So then after the coup, the military had a list of all of these different actors, who was involved, where they were based, what they did, and how much money they were receiving, and their bank accounts. So, you know, of course, then these local organizations were getting targeted. They had military guys turning up in their apartment blocks, terrorizing them in the middle of the night, you know, all because they consented to, well, I think it was coerced for a lot of them. You can't hang money over people's heads and say that it's, you know, voluntary. But for because they got formally registered within this regime. And so I think that's, you know, one of the things that we want to do is try to create a bridge between the compliance regimes of donor governments and the risk mitigation technologies that are being used by local actors to ensure that they can continue to deliver aid to their communities safely. So Koala Pay does that by creating a smart contracting and payments platform, which is fully transparent, but it's not bound to any one state or company.
Yeah. I think that's a really important point too to make, because we've chatted about this quite a bit with some previous folks on the podcast as well. I'm reminded of Chris Goes at Anoma Network. They're building privacy shielded transactions, barter transactions, essentially. But basically, the barter system is not really the important part. The privacy shielding is interesting, right? Because a lot of the gruff, a lot of the stuff, the criticisms and stuff that are leveled at DeFi are often, oh, well, why would you want to have an anonymous transaction? I don't see that. Are you trying to do crimes? And it's like, yes, obviously, there are a lot of crimes that can be aided and abetted by anonymous transactions, but there are real use cases here, like the one you just pointed out, right?
Exactly. And also, I don't know, I think that's a little bit of a red herring in the sense that whenever it comes up, I'm just kind of going, do you not live in the world? These things are happening in every system. You know, there are bad actors in every system. That doesn't mean that there aren't a lot of good actors in the systems too. And so of course we try to come up with means of minimizing those risks. But to pretend that this is a kind of unique flaw to DeFi, I think is, you know, a little bit naive or potentially quite self-serving, which I think is often where it's really coming from when you hear that criticism. But I digress.
That's also true. Well, then taking it back to what y'all are building, then I think you definitely touched on why people would need something like this. But I think you're also backing into a number of things around, accountability. The ability to basically say, like, on the home front, or, you know, the global north or the donor side, whatever you want to call it, there's the compliance regime that you are shooting to be completely on the right side of. But then you also want to make sure that once that money is on the other side of it and a beneficiary is receiving it, that they're receiving it in a safe way. So walk us through, how does the platform actually work from end to end? Maybe you could pick a real, maybe make up a fake transaction, or however you'd like to explain it. Okay. I'm very curious.
Well, I wanted to go back just really quickly to the previous question, because a lot of our focus on what we're doing is on the donor level, right? And NGOs and all of that. But that's only sort of one piece of that puzzle. The second piece is around that sort of business and corporate social responsibility aspect. And my understanding of corporate social responsibility, because I know this is a weighted term that's contested by a lot of folks, is like more of a public-private partnerships concept. If you're working in a community, if you are creating value in a community, then that value should be redistributed, and that should be done in a way that is, you know, in partnership with those local communities. So I'm going to use that term, even though I know that historically it's, you know, contested in a lot of ways, but it's an easy way to talk about businesses trying to do good, right? Whether environmental or social. So businesses, I think, struggle to find opportunities for really local level impact because they lack sufficient in-country context a lot of the time. So they might know that they have a couple of, you know, employees who work in that place, or that they, you know, maybe have a factory in one location, and then they notice that something is going on and they want to respond, and they really don't know how to do it, where to send the money, who's a trusted actor, who's an effective actor. And so as a result, they tend to default to giving money to UNICEF, Save the Children, Oxfam. And I'm not saying that these groups are not capable of doing good work. What I'm saying is that a lot of the money that they raise is going towards costs associated with their acting as contracts and payments processing houses for donor governments who are trying to do work which requires high levels of local actor engagement in order to actually gain access. So no one, I think, wants to see their donations used to subsidize an inefficiency. And that's what Koala Pay is trying to work at, is making it easier to find and fund those aid activities which align with the company's mission, vision, values, but in a more direct way. So you can really see, okay, we supported this activity. 100% of that money went to that activity. This is now a relationship that we have with this local actor, as opposed to something that has to be intermediated by UNICEF, and which, you know, involves a lot of overheads, a lot of inefficiency, and, you know, and a lot of pooled funding. That's the other thing. You know, if you want your to really be able to see the impact of your giving, it's hard to do that when you're one of, you know, a million other companies that are giving to that same fund. It's hard to know exactly what your money is being used to achieve. So that's number two.
Oh, sorry. One second before you go, before you continue. I'm very interested in the local actor engagement side of this, right? So like, to some extent you have these, you know, giant monoliths of charity who are, you know, they're, like you said, they do what they do. They're doing good work, but it's about efficiency, right? So on this side with you folks, you know, when you're looking at building a funding platform that connects you with local grassroots actors, folks on the ground, how are you folks going about that? Because it sounds really, really messy and difficult. So I'd love to learn more about that.
It is messy and difficult. And I think the important thing to say there is that we're focused on working with people who have a long experience in the communities, who are from those communities, and also recognizing that, like, just because somebody is, for example, Burmese, doesn't mean that they are the right person to advise on the best local actor in a rural community if they're from an urban community. In the same way that if you asked me, what should we do to help elevate Mormon women in Utah, I would not be the right person to ask that question of. So it is mind-boggling to me that we still use this kind of tokenization to say, like, okay, this person is, you know, you're from that country, so you're now an expert on the whole country. I mean, that's madness, and it's bizarre to me that we do that. But,
and also to clarify, we're talking about a different form of tokenization. We're not talking about token cap tables.
Exactly. And so we work really with trusted networks of academics, researchers, aid workers who really know and are committed to the communities that we're working in, to identify those really strong local partners. We also talk with the donors themselves to ask about the local partners that they want to work with, but are struggling to work with for whatever reason related to the, as I said, the contracting challenges or the cross-border money movement challenges. So if they have money that they have sort of earmarked for a local actor in a specific location, and they're trying to figure out the best way to move it without having to engage a larger NGO, then we can help them to move that money. So it's really about a sustained commitment to the places where we are working and working with people from those communities, including some really, really smart crypto kids. I keep saying crypto kids, they're not kids. They're, you know, a range of, you know, ages, but, you know, people who are very savvy with the peer-to-peer exchanges in the communities where they're working. And normally when I say we're doing this in Myanmar, the first thing people will say is, well, but crypto is illegal in Myanmar. And my normal response is, well, it's illegal under the military junta. So if you acknowledge the military junta as the legitimate government, then I have a whole other conversation to have with you. The people's elected government has said that crypto is their official currency. And they've even created a digital wallet to enable peer-to-peer transactions.
Wow. That's their,
so there's an interesting sort of conversation to be had there about legalities and regimes and whatever else, but also a lot of the Myanmar responses run out of Thailand. And so Thailand obviously is a place that has a very robust crypto ecosystem. And, you know, so, you know, there are different ways to think about this, but to say, you know, the people that we would work with to facilitate the local partner engagement, and that includes helping them to, you know, set up a wallet, figure out how to mint their proposals. And I will go into how the platform actually works so that makes more sense. But also in how they manage the last mile aspect of their transactions. That's all done with a white glove service with crypto people who are consistently and constantly tracking the changes in how the markets are working in those areas. Because we, you know, initially we thought about trying to program a singular service that we could do, that we could automate. But the reality is things are changing too quickly on the ground for that to be productive. And it was just going to be better to have a kind of constant monitoring and community style approach to that. But So
I'm hearing this and I think the model is really cool. And I've been taking notes, trying to through where the efficiency is happening with Qualapay. And my experience in the space has been mostly it's kind of just like on the sidelines, following a diplomat around the world that was deploying money locally. And then subsequently working with some of these big primes who are the intermediaries that you talk about. And what I'm trying to understand, so for the past year, I worked on a platform to try to help the US government kind of reimagine its global healthcare supply chain, which is going up for this massive bid next year. And so all of the things that you're talking about are kind of dear to my heart. And so I guess what I'm trying to understand is like, how is this system going to be better than the primes? And I think what would be useful for me is if we broke it down into four different areas, the identification of local partners. So when I think of how local partners are actually identified on the ground today, I think of like the fact that there's, let's take the biggest aid agency in the world, like USAID. There's missions all around the world. They have staff on hand. So, you know, that would be kind of one area that I'd be interested in. Then like identification of capacity builders, right? So it's like, so you've done research for FHI 360, or how do the other primes actually attract and recruit talent? They're increasingly moving to machine learning to do a lot of this work. And so I'm interested to better understand how you think about kind of the knowledge set and skills and how to identify local actors that can actually do the capacity building with local partners. I think the third area is compliance, right? So like when I think of from a compliance perspective, the way that these primes are now moving, they're now moving to kind of instantaneous integration with all of the different databases around the world for known terrorists, known money launderers. And then the fourth is financial transfers. And so you mentioned kind of this hop of five different hops to get to money from the US or the UK to Myanmar. And my understanding is what one of the benefits of kind of having these large primes is that they actually have regional subsidiaries. And so there's only really one hop and then it goes. And that's one of the reasons that there is such this kind of heavy overhead structure is because of that architecture. So I'd be interested if I get into the details on the business model of Qualapay and where exactly the efficiency is happening here.
Yeah. So Qualapay is effectively a smart contracting platform. That's really what it comes down to. So the way we've chosen to make that look is like an NFT marketplace. There are various reasons for that, and I'll explain those later. But ultimately, at its core, it's a smart contracts platform. And part of the reason why we talk about it in that language and not as an NFT exchange is because there's still a really high level of discomfort with a lot of different actors, especially institutional actors, around the use of NFTs. So, and then that has to do with the kind of speculative use of them in so many other ways. That's done a lot of harm to the ability to talk about the kind of underlying technology behind them. But so when you log on to Koala Pay, you will see what looks like a marketplace with proposals for specific activities. And those proposals will say the number of beneficiaries, the type of sector that it's in. So is it an education project? Is it a livelihoods project? Is it environmental response? You know, so you can kind of see, and you can search by those different, let's call them verticals. And then it'll also specify how long they think they need to implement that activity and the sort of costs associated. That, if you were to buy that, you would be funding the activities outlined in that proposal. When you're in that platform, you will only ever see local proposals that have been put forward by local actors who have gone through a rigorous due diligence and vetting system, which is the same as, you said, the sort of access to the kind of common questions related to sanctions lists, counterterrorism, but which also goes a step further and includes a community consultation element. So a local actor to be included in Koala Pay needs to have some level of recognition and support buy-in from the communities in which they purport to carry out their activities. So the ideal there is that when you find this activity, you fund this activity, it's a relationship now that's created between you and that actor. And the money is moving from your wallet to their wallet. And that, so it's a singular transaction. At that point, they're in a position to make decisions about how best to move the money ultimately to their beneficiaries. So if they're living and working in a country where they can do direct wallet transfers and they can set up their beneficiaries with their own wallets, then that's something they could do. If they need to withdraw the money into fiat in a place like Thailand and then use their trusted networks or their existing sort of means to get that money to their beneficiaries, and that's something they can do. So it gives them a little bit more flexibility while still enabling us to come back to donors and say, if you want to see where this money has gone, you can do a chain analysis and see the movement of how any transactions that have happened after that initial movement of cash, movement of money from buyer to seller. In terms of identification of local partners, you're totally right that there are the large primes who do have regional offices and presence. I can tell you coming from the other side of that, that I've been on a number of calls with primes who come to me and say, can you help us identify the right, you know, local staff and partners in these countries? So, you know, that whole ecosystem in terms of identification, yes, they may have a presence there. It doesn't always mean that they're the most tapped into who's actually providing services closest to communities. And again, the actors that they're going to feel most comfortable working with are the actors who have designed themselves to be visible and easily accessible to their needs. So they're going to have, you know, in a place like Myanmar, English-speaking M&E staff. They're going to have an enormous finance team to be able to do the amount of financial reporting that's required by those kinds of large consortium projects. All of which makes it really hard for certain local actors to engage. And a lot of them simply won't because of that. And in terms of, you know, identifying the right people to be doing capacity development, what we're really looking for in a place like, let's say, the Myanmar Thailand response are people who are from those communities, who are already working in things like digital education, digital safety and security, cyber, general kind of like cyber, personal safety, digital rights, you know, people who have those kinds of profiles who are now also doing a lot of work in the crypto space. Those are the people who are going to be working hands-on with the local communities, and all of that supplemented by support from other members of the team. So it's really a network of networks approach, which is something that's not uncommon within the aid sector, but with the focus being on going with 100% of the program money in the sense of what's articulated in that NFT goes to the local partner. The ancillary services that sort of surround that and make it as successful as possible are funded through another mechanism.
Okay. Yeah, it makes sense. I mean, I think like the discovery of local partners seems to be the biggest challenge in this space. And the question is, what's the business model around that that can embed in the compliance risk at scale, right? Because and this is why you have, I forget what the number is, but maybe 6% of USAID dollars go to local partners, and Samantha Power wants to get it up to 25%. over the course of 4 years, and that seems almost impossible.
She's also walked that back from the original goal, which was 30%. So,
but I think it's, I mean, like you talk to the CEOs of the primes, it's not, these are not dumb people. They're very smart people that are thinking about this problem, and they're trying to think about like how to solve it, because there's a lot of money in it, and the U.S. government is their major, is their client first and foremost. And so they know that the U.S. government actually wants this to some extent. And so I guess like the question that I would kind of push on if I were an investor in this would be to say, okay, how are you going to do discovery in a way that's better than these really well-funded organizations that have been on the ground for a number of years? And then the second question I would ask is the way that the State Department sets up its overseas kind of project managers in USAID. USAID used to be separate, and I'm sure you know this, and now it's part of the State Department. But you're not allowed to stay in a region for 2 to 4 years, right? Because of corruption risk. You actually, through building the local relationships, you're statistically more likely to use those local relationships in a corrupt way. And so like, I think like this is, and that's why you move diplomats around the world, because there was analysis kind of done on that. So,
I'm smiling because I think there's a real strong argument for that analysis being a handy way to justify what is also a longstanding policy of moving people around so they don't become too un-American. I mean, used to be a whole fear that if you let people stay in one place for too long, then they would start to affiliate more with a single place than their country of origin. That was the risk factor. So I haven't seen that.
Everyone who goes into the Foreign Service becomes un-American, right? Like that, like you compare someone who's done 2 or 3 tours to the average person from Iowa, and like they're not the same creature anymore, you know?
Yeah. I would be hesitant to put too much credence in that line of argumentation for why they move people around. But and that's true. If we were doing this in a way, we would be doing a similar dynamics. If we were doing this in a way that meant that like our model was dependent on sending a white kid out to each of these different places, because we can only work comfortably with people that look like us, and or that look like me or that look like the majority of donors, but that is not our model, and very intentionally so. And I would say that that is, one of the challenges of these large consortiums. And you're right, there are a lot of really smart people trying to fix this problem and who are thinking about how to fix this problem. The systems and the structures are so big. And at some point, those systems become self-sustaining. And the people who are in them and who are profiting off of them have very little incentive to downsize their staff. Having a large presence in a place, physical presence in a place, means that you have to consistently go for that funding. And there is this mindset in the aid industry that you need to maintain the amount of aid money that you have by spending it every time. And so there's this real drive to spend to make sure that you get the same budget the next year. It's easy to do that when you have a bunch of really expensive foreign nationals. And I'm not saying that it's a grand conspiracy or anything like that. It's just that, there is the larger strategic direction that these organizations want to go. And of course, loads of people are really dedicated to the localization agenda. There are reasons why, if you're institutionally designed to profit off of an inefficient system, that you are going to find it very difficult to reorient your organization to no longer sort of perpetuate that same relationship and dynamic. And so, in terms of discovery and like the way that we're approaching this, it's really not about, I'll start by saying, it's very hard to work with people who don't fit your expectation of how social organizations should work. So if you're coming from, for example, the USAID system, and you're looking, the first question that people are going to ask is, are you locally registered? Do you have a valid legal registration? The problem with that is that, as I explained before, legal registration in a country where your government is out to kill you, literally, is not going to help provide services to communities. So this is the challenge. This is the balance. And I'm not saying that Koala Pay should replace these systems necessarily, or these existing consortiums of different actors. I think that the objective that we have is to take away some of that, the pressure to act in the ways that are now most inefficient, and put them elsewhere so that you can focus on delivering actual programs rather than on, being a contracting house or a pass-through entity, because I don't think that serves anyone unless the sheer purpose that we're doing this is to keep really big offices of people employed.
That makes a lot of sense to me. I mean, I think it's really honing in on, I think the payment provision is a problem. I think the identification is a problem, and like how to scale those in a way that doesn't rely on the primes becoming your customer is also a hard problem, but really interesting if you crack it.
That's the thing is, you know, people have been saying for a long time, this is a really big problem. We are going to try a bunch of different things and see what works. And I think that's kind of how we're approaching this as well, is that having spoken with a lot of local aid implementers, local aid actors on the ground who, you know, saying, expressing their frustrations with the system as it works. I mean, for example, if you are a small local youth organization working in Shan State in Myanmar, and you have, you know, you're serving maybe 10,000 to 15,000 beneficiaries every month, and you have a donor who says, you can spend 5 months writing this complex proposal in which you're going to have to speak to all 17 of our key objectives and talk to the points that are outlined in our log frame and our indicators, which we've set, you know, because of part of our larger program that you've had no line of sight on whatsoever. And now you have to explain to us why your program satisfies all these different elements. And then on top of that, you need to articulate to us how you're going to do ongoing monitoring and evaluation of that. Something that, again, you had no say in, and now it's your life's blood whether or not you are successful against these metrics. And on top of that, you're going to have to hire an entirely new financial coordinator to process the documents and the contracts and the various reporting things that we have that are unique to us. That for $30,000 is just not worth it for a lot of these organizations. And so, you know, or if it is, the number of small organizations that I've seen completely broken into pieces because they accept some of this money, they get money from a donor that comes with all of these conditions, which they cannot respond to. And they're struggling so hard to be able to do it, to write the reports, to, you know, bring their, you know, whatever like European gets flown in to do an evaluation for 2 weeks, you know, to accommodate all of that. At the end of the day, they just can't then focus on the thing they really need to do. And on top of that, I mean, I think a lot of people don't realize this, but the way grants work a lot of the time is that if you have a line item in your grant, which says, I am going to spend this money on petrol, and then the price of fuel goes up massively overnight, you have to get permission to reallocate your own money, what money that's been given to you, from one line item to another. So let's then say that you're a small organization that's been doing agricultural programming in Ukraine before the war. And then you have the Russian invasion. And you're like, I could use this money to, you know, the money that I have, I could use this now to start doing emergency medical response, but I have to get permission first. And like that whole thing, just this, you know, there are a ton of reasons why that's problematic. And so the way that we focus is not on sort of saying, we are going to fund local organizations that do projects that we think are important. So there's not going to be a process of saying, we have this great big Koala Pay education program, and here are the different local organizations that are, you know, contributing to one aspect of that program. It's what do these local organizations think are the activities that they need to carry out, allowing them to articulate those rapidly and allowing people to find and fund them rapidly. So it's really about trying to put that the power in the hands of local organizations to articulate what community needs are and to advocate for the kinds of projects that they think are most important at very particular moments in time.
Really cool. Yeah. And just like, I'll say one last thing and then Jad, I'll kind of hand it back over to you. But where I think like just in the pain of kind of building this marketplace over the past year, where I think there's a real opportunity is kind of becoming I forget the name of the application. That's essentially a plugin for KYC it essentially just takes the whole process of KYC and makes it an API that you can plug into. And that for me what I think is really necessary in the development space is essentially this compliance app. Because the number of API integrations that we were going to have to do to do this well, plus the fact that those API integrations only handle the traditional way of thinking about risk and therefore exclude all the people that are not registered, et cetera, I think is a huge opportunity and something that's really exciting about Qualify.
Yeah, thanks. I mean, I think what I will say about that is that risk, I mean, first of all, I don't think it's a surprise. Everyone knows humans are really bad at understanding risk, but risk is not apolitical either, right? The conceptualization of it. So the things that we consider risky as donors or people coming from, you know, global minority countries often have to do with things like compliance and money. And you know, that's what we're focused on. It's, and that's fine. But local actors and local organizations will have their own understanding of risk and risk management and what's important to them and why that's important. And right now, what happens because of the way that we do this is that we totally use our form of risk and encompass those local actors. And that often creates risks for them that we can't see and that they're now in a position that they can't actually protect themselves either. And so it's, you know, what I'm really interested in is this articulation of various different concepts of risk, making sure that the parties involved are both able to have their concerns recognized equally, and that that's the kind of heart of the arrangement, as opposed to the way we do it now.
Can you give an example of that? Because like the way that I think about risk is there's two risks, right? You're financing someone who's actually a terrorist, or you are financing someone or committing kind of corruption. So FCPA, right? So if I'm an American, yeah. I'm gonna don't, you know, give money through Qualpay and whatever your terms and conditions, like, I mean, maybe the platform will go down, but I, as an actor, if I'm sending a lot of money through the platform, I'm going to have a lot of legal trouble. So what's a concrete example of mitigating that risk in the way that you're just articulating?
So it's not about the question of either or. That's what I'm saying, is that we need to consider those things, of course, but we can't get into the mindset that those are the only risks that are worth mitigating. And I think what happens now is this subcontracting process in the international aid industry subcontracts a lot of physical risk down to the local actors who are actually the ones on the ground doing the activities. And you see this consistently in terms of things like access. You'll see that, you know, a large NGO can't access an area because it's determined to be unsafe for people to access that area, or because they're worried that if they, you know, they can't uphold the sort of standard do no harm principles if they go into that place. And so then rather than kind of going back to the drawing board, they just find a local partner and they push all of that risk down onto a local partner. And so what happens when you have an economy that is so hierarchical, which the aid sector is, that those local actors are often not in a position where they can comfortably articulate their concerns and have them taken seriously without risking just having their funding pulled. So then sometimes they do undertake risks that they would maybe not be so comfortable taking because they're worried that if they don't, they'll lose access to their funding. So it's about finding a way that both of those things can coexist. And I would say, for example, that it's an enormous risk for a local organization to be dependent on a donor government that decides whether or not they care about that place. I mean, we're seeing this happening in the UK right now, this question of whether or not the UK Treasury is going to block non-essential aid funding or non-life-saving aid funding because of the commitment of the UK government to the Ukraine. That is a risk, right? For people whose livelihoods are now completely determined by their ability to access that money. So this concept of risk as being more holistic and having different key, you know, actors within it, I think is really important.
Yeah, I think like you nail it there. And it's more of a yes and, right? Because the two risks that Martin are pointing out from the donor side are things that your platform will have to control anyway. Otherwise, all the governments are going to, you're a big target for them, obviously, because you'd be like, oh, this is just a terrorism funding platform or whatever. But really, you're really arguing for a much more expansive definition of risk, right? So, and I think it's really, really cool because at the other end of it, you're basically saying that you'll be able to at least say, yes, we can cover all of the compliance risks that we need to. We are also going to make sure that we can use, you know, whatever technologies we need to, whatever informal networks we build to ensure that privacy and other concerns on the last mile are covered as well, because we consider those risks too.
Exactly. Something, it's a bit of a more sort of a broader definition. And that's very intentional. It's not just because, you know, we think that this is essential to being able to get money into these countries. What we really want to push for is this understanding that these systems, we should move towards treating the movement of international aid money in so that it feels more like mutual aid than like charity. It shouldn't be something that comes because we say, oh, well, you know, we deign to give you this money. But now you have to earn it by doing all the things we want you to do. It should be something that builds relationships between individuals and between the nation states that they live in, however you want to articulate that. And the first step in recognizing that agency of local actors is letting them determine what it is they think needs to happen in their communities and giving them a platform where that's the front and center, what it is that you see when you log in. So you don't log into Koala Pay and see here are, you know, the GEFA countries this year and what the US government thinks should happen there. You see this local actor in this place says that they need to do this program. And that, I think, is a helpful way to even visually to start. And again, not a solution, but a step on the path towards a better way of doing things. It is a step towards making those perspectives more visible to a broader range of people who are interested in helping to build stronger, more resilient communities.
Yeah, and I think like one last thing on that, you know, to the extent that it's kind of so much of the aid industry is reactive, right? So there's a flood in Pakistan and now a bunch of money just flows to Pakistan. And so like identifying kind of layering on top geopolitical and climate risk and using some of the third party data sources today that have that information and can project out risk over kind of years or decade long periods now, and then tapping into those communities and figuring out, okay, how do we build resilience into these communities? What are the projects that actually need to be funded here in advance? Getting them listed on the platform, building liquidity around that resilience, and then connecting those communities to the diaspora could also be a way of kind of parallel track to not having to even go through the traditional development aid industry.
Yeah.
Which you see happen, but it all goes through American Red Cross or through all these guys today, right? When it happens and it's all reactive.
Yeah. I mean, actually what really happens is that a bunch of money goes to American Red Cross and then it goes to a bunch of local aid actors who respond as quickly as possible, a lot of the time, or the local, you know, Red Cross branch in that country. So there are definitely ways that we can think about identifying where there should be priorities that we can all agree on. And one of the things that we want to have within Koala Pay is a library of data and information that's available to everyone who's involved in the platform so that you can see some of those projections. But again, I really want to emphasize that no one is better placed to know what their community needs in that moment than a local actor. And so we can definitely be thinking about, you know, education, and there's a large amount of donor education that goes into this. And that's why, and we're, you know, planning resources around that. But the idea that we can just find a better system by which to mobilize our money, quote unquote, to go to these local community actors, and you know, that we could like come up with some sort of AI system that might do that or pull in this data or that data, all of that can and should still happen. But ultimately, the perspective that we're putting forward is that no one is better placed to determine the needs of their communities than these community actors. And they can do that with our platform in a very quick way. Because like you said, there's a flood in Pakistan, you know, people rush to want to respond to that. There are those kinds of events happening all over the world. And so, you know, the things that get media play are not necessarily always, you know, the things that actually potentially have opportunities where we could best support communities or where the need is most grave. So what we really want to do is create a means by which, if you're a person who lives, you know, in Brooklyn or who lives in San Francisco or in Paris or whatever, that you can log on to this marketplace and see the kinds of things that local communities are putting forward. If you say, okay, I heard there was something that happened on the news in Pakistan, and I open, you know, and I search for things that are being proposed in Pakistan, and I can see, okay, there are, you know, organizations that normally focus on education are putting forward proposals for work that they want to do on flood relief. You can sort of see how communities are automatically responding to things that happen and what it is that they're putting forward, as opposed to having to wait for an algorithm or a diplomat to say, okay, we've decided now that we want this to happen. Now we have to mobilize a prime. Now we have to mobilize the various sort of architecture of like international partners under that umbrella. And then they'll have to mobilize the local partners and all of that. The question you bring up about liquidity is a really interesting one, because you know, there have been some models that are similar to what we want to do, but where they've used staking, I am very hesitant about that. I think they had a lot of Terra exposure. I'm not sure, but, and, you know, so I think there's a lot to dig into there. The way that we think about liquidity is we think about core funding to local organizations. So the sort of third pain point that we're trying to solve with Koala Pay is specifically focused on the Web3 sort of sector. And one of the things that we're working towards, and one of the, we do now have our first third-party partner, which is an NFT exchange based out of the UK, that will be putting a kind of roundup feature or a donate to feature that will go into a fund that eventually will be used as core funding for the various participants in the platform. And so that'll be both the local organizations, and that's core funding. So it's unearmarked. It's saying, we think that, you know, we're going to give you this money so that you can just develop the things that you think are important. Maybe you want to do training for your staff. Maybe you, you know, want to do a project that you don't think anyone's ever going to pay for, but you think it's really important. It's core funding, which they could also use to just sit as an emergency fund to mobilize as a kind of quick response if and when they needed to. But if you're a donor to the platform, if you've bought an NFT on the platform, then that would come as sort of a matching fund that you could use to either double down on existing investments or investments, you know, things that you're funding, or, you know, to add to your portfolio things that you want to fund. So it's a way to kind of reward people with a shared value that's created. I think that's one of the things that we want to demonstrate, is that you can use as something that is socially and environmentally conscious in terms of how you want to do it, and that creates value, builds value for everybody who's involved in that. But that value, and the way we think about how it's redistributed, is different than maybe a kind of traditional free market approach.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And then the last thing I was going to say, and then Jawhead, I promise I'll hand it back over to you, is that kind of the governance aspect of this. I've been working kind of with, and so in some of these multi-sided marketplaces, that over time as they scale and the liquidity problem is solved and the cost of acquisition comes down through organic search, the taxonomy of search, when you give governance rights to, like, one of the kind of biggest areas of debate within these organizations where governance rights has been devolved to the value creating stakeholders. So in this case, the value creating stakeholder is the local provider or the local expert, or the local advisor. They really care about the both the taxonomy and how search happens on the platform, right? And so thinking through, okay, we need to develop this taxonomy because people need to know, how are they going to search, right? Are they going to search for flooding in Pakistan? Are they going to search for these other things? But then having that feedback loop where the control over that taxonomy leads to all the dynamics that are required in these multi-sided marketplaces, but at the same time, affords for feedback from the community to actually influence who shows up first and how they're categorized, which has been really hard in the aid community, has been really hard in the ESG and CSR community on thinking through, you know, what are the interventions and outcomes.
Yeah, you're right. I mean, it's a challenge. I think one of the you know, additional challenges that we're thinking through is that because we do have this roundup donate to function, one of the elements of that is that when you get to the page where you get to say, okay, yes, I want to donate, that you will be able to determine or to say where you want that to go. If you want that to go specifically to education funds, or you want that to go to environmental funds, or you want that to go to health. And so we do have to come up with certain terms that are going to be broad enough that they enable that, because on the back end, what you'll end up with is a dashboard of the impact that's attached to your wallet. If you give in on any of these third-party platforms, it'll track your cumulative impact over time. So it needs to be broad enough that we can do that while maintaining a level of granularity that's meaningful to users. At the same time, the way that a local partner understands what is health might be very different from the way that somebody in the international aid sector does. And again, this is where, and this is not to say that it's right or wrong necessarily, I obviously have a perspective on this, but the Koala Pay perspective on this is that if a local actor says this is health, it's health. And it's not our job to police their understanding of that term. So that's something that you'll need to know if you get into the Koala Pay ecosystem, is that first and foremost, sort of decisions about what means what are coming from and accommodating to local actors. And that is a different approach. And there will be some donors, totally aware that that will be off-putting for some donors. What we're hoping too, and this is partially why we're doing this. I mean, there are a lot of reasons why we're doing this as a Web3 product, obviously, but a big part of why we're doing this is because we think that message resonates really strongly with people in the space who want things to be more decentralized, who want to see a greater share of voice from, you know, communities that are outside of the sort of standard minority countries. And so we think that there's also an opportunity here for folks within the Web3 space to take a leadership position and to start moving on something like this, which then kind of creates track record that will be helpful in showcasing that these kinds of things can work and that there are benefits to taking this approach in terms of efficacy and outcome. And I think, you know, that's where, you know, at the end of the day, I am a researcher. I will always be a researcher. And, you know, the fact that I did start out my career doing monitoring and evaluation and designing sort of systems to enable adaptive management and impact evaluation, I'm going to be tracking this throughout our various iterations as we build to see where we can improve, where, how we can make things better. And that kind of commitment to learning, I think, is really critical to how we grow. Because you're right, this is a challenge. And anything that involves trying to govern people living in different places, govern together with and as a part of, requires a lot of coordination and overcoming challenges that maybe haven't even been anticipated. But I think that that's, I would rather be part of a complicated system of governance in which I am an equal member to other people with whom I'm working, than being part of a governance structure in which I am responsible for making decisions for other people. So that's really the kind of the line we're taking.
Yeah, I think like that's an interesting spot too to begin to bring us towards the end of this, which is there's two interesting things there on the outcome side that you're privy to. One, of course, the folks who are become donors on the platform will want to see some verification. You spent, you know, you said the earlier part of your career was basically all built around monitoring, verification, all that. But you're going to have opportunities to measure impact in new ways, I think, right? Like, because you're actually going to, of course, there'd be some donors, you know, big enough client, whatever, goes, I want this thing, right? And it's like, hey, it's great you want that thing, but you can just go look for what matches it over there. Or maybe you give them a little bit of white glove treatment, whatever. But then there are going to be entirely new ways for you to measure that. So how are you folks thinking of that? Like when something is, it's almost something that Martin backed into around like the taxonomy of like new outcomes, right? Like how are you thinking about capturing those and really making them clear to participants on the donor side?
Yeah. I mean, this is going to be something that's going to immediately mark me out as being enormously nerdy, if that wasn't clear already. But one of my favorite techniques has always been indicator seeding, which is, and again, I'm a qualitative researcher, I'm an anthropologist, so it's always going to come down to community perspectives for me. But talking to communities and saying, this thing happened, you know, what did you think about it? What was the most significant change for you? Was that good or bad? Why? And, you know, a more involved, I mean, look, there are ways in which what we're doing is going to create a lot of efficiencies. And the primary way is that it is going to make sure that 100% of program funds are used for activities. What we're not saying is that we are going to automate all of the monitoring and evaluation or whatever else, because that's part of governance and community building. And that has to happen in a different way for now, I think. It has to have a human touch. And so, you know, seeing and hearing from communities what it was that they valued from the local partners, what it was that they valued, what they found complicated and difficult, and keeping everything really transparent in that library that we want to put together is a big part of our approach here. So yeah, I'm really excited to see what's going to come out from, you know, unexpected, hopefully positive unexpected outcomes, but in general, kind of commitment to thinking about impact in a different way, I think is, you know, is what's really exciting to me. What I will say is that, you know, obviously, we're cognizant of the space that we're working in. So we are going to offer people who buy these NFTs, fund these activities, a means of doing an assessment of, you know, whether or not the activity took place, how communities responded to it. Did they, you know, were they satisfied with it? And more complex systems, those of monitoring and evaluation. But critically, we make it clear that that is an additional service and an ancillary cost, because we want to really make the point that, again, the risk management related to you needing to know that your money was spent in a particular way or that an activity happened in a particular way is something that is important, but that should not be implied in the funding that you provide to a local actor. So you can definitely have it, but you have to, you know, allocate sufficient budget to it.
Got it. Well, I think that's a good spot. I'm super excited to see where you end up with this, especially on this, you know, interesting opportunity to really integrate new, really fluid, and ultimately, I hope, concrete and real measurements of impact, right? Other than just being maybe a few hundred lines in a spreadsheet that are rolled up, you know, across whatever analyst ends up looking at them. So that's awesome. Thanks for your time today. I think the last thing we'd say is take a couple seconds to chill and let folks know where to find you, because, you know, you're building a Web3 platform. So I'm going to use chill with you. This is our parlance.
Cool. Yeah. Well, first, thanks so much for having me. I feel like every time I talk to people about what we want to do, it's always really helpful to, you know, hear the kinds of questions that people have and the things that the platform immediately makes them think of. It's different for different audiences. So it's always good to have those conversations. In terms of shilling, we are in the process now of raising for our MVP. So if you are someone who's interested in what we're doing, please get in touch. We'd love to hear from you. If you're someone who wants to follow what we're doing, we do have a Twitter handle. We've been a little bit on stealth so far, so there's not a lot there, but it will be more soon. So if you want to go and follow us over at koalapay.org and our Twitter handle, then we would be happy to have you. And it will motivate us to be more active in those spaces. So please do put that pressure on us.
Awesome. Thanks a lot for your time. Melanie, it was great chatting with you. And thanks for walking us through your history and the platform.
Thanks so much for having me.